gift. I would have preferred they send you with a lime. I am grieved to have offended you, Queen Ursaria. Crafty received an indifferent wave. I am rarely offended, and then only when I have failed to find a better use for my energies. The sultans hold great power. What good does it do my kingdom to deny it? I am also powerful, named for the she-bear, and such a beast is nowhere more dangerous than where she lairs, especially when the audacious hunter mistakes that she slumbers. It made Oates uneasy when neither Crafty nor Alamra tried to convince the queen she wasn't being hunted. Though he watched the race, his ears were witness to a different contest, and he couldn't tell who was fucking winning. The bastards were midway through their fifth circuit. Culprit had fallen behind several places, his hog nearly blown. He'd done well, but inexperience had cost him. Still, Oates was proud of him. The chief would have been too, were she here to see. Though if she were, he reckoned this palaver with the queen would be going very differently.
"The lots see that you have been roused, Majesty," Alamra said. "The blood spilled cannot be undone. It is the hope of our chieftain that further war can be prevented." "By placing Manrique on the throne," the queen said, amused.
"The lots allowed to descend further into barbarity, weakening our bulwark against the orcs, all while miserable Rike has a crown on his head and a Tyrkanian hand up his ass. It is everything my father warned against. Indeed, it could be said I exist solely to prevent that very outcome. Yes, I am roused, and will not be lulled by well-mannered mongrels, no matter how pretty or charming." Oates fought the urge to look to his left. However Alamra and Crafty reacted, they were silent. Sluggard entered the final circuit with two other riders in contention for the prize, both Hispartan. Another cavalero and a rider from Anville weren't far behind, with Polecat, a cavalero, and a Majethi on their heels. Cat looked determined to catch Sluggard, but Oates didn't think he had the time, even without the other racers aggravating his pursuit. The riders, seasoned enough to pace their mounts, now pushed them to unleash their last bouts of speed.
"There is a saying I am certain you know," the queen said. "The orcs have the strength to conquer the world, but to do so, they will have to walk."
The Hispartan's dogging Sluggard converged upon him, one to his right, the other behind. The man beside him reached, attempting to wrest him from the saddle. Sluggard fended him off, but they were coming into the final turn, and a gap formed while his concentration shifted. The cavalero at the rear bulled to occupy the inside, leaving Sluggard pinched between the horsemen. They struck at him, keeping pace, trying to make him slow to escape their blows. He held firm, taking the beating. The crowds on either side of the field were near to frenzy as the trio of battling riders came to the final straight.
"My father oft spoke another piece of wisdom."
The dead Majethi horse lay upon the track, a javelin's throw from the finish, and directly in Pala's path. Hemmed by the cavaleros, Sluggard could not avoid it. His hog could jump the corpse, but he risked being unseated by the frails. He had to slow. Instead, he leaped from his hog to the horse on his left, landing behind the rider. To the crowd's astonishment, Sluggard heaved the cavalero off the animal's back, sending him flying over the rope to land in the center of the track.
"He said it was fortunate male mongrels were sterile."
Sluggard hopped forward into the vacant saddle and remained on the galloping animal until Pala jumped the dead horse. As soon as his hog was over, Sluggard sprang back to his razor, using the motion to kick the last cavalero off his mount.
"For if half-orcs could breed true."
Pala burst over the finish, and Sluggard's arm struck the air to the feverish adulation of hundreds.
"They would rule all the lands of the earth."
Chapter 34. The Majethi horse proved to be the only casualty of the race. Some of the riders suffered broken bones, including the man Sluggard kicked, but thankfully he rolled clear of the track before the horses coming up behind trampled him. With dusk fast approaching,
the queen called a halt to the games. The court retired to the pavilions, where the day's competitors were invited to receive their fawning. Fearing reprisal, Oates gathered the hoof at the paddock. "You can't mean for us to hide back here," Sluggard said, bemused. He raised a frustrated arm at the rear of the pavilions, less than a thrum shot away, where the sounds of merriment pulsed through the silk and canvas. Oates didn't answer, and Sluggard paced with increasing vexation, though he uttered no further protest. Anselmo Volador came to his rescue.
"Your presence is sorely missed,"
the weak-voiced tax collector said, after crossing the stretch of plain with a pair of men-at-arms.
"Reckon the only thing sore is the pride of all them cavaleros," Oates replied. "I don't think your queen would take kindly to her festival being spoiled by a knife fight."
"Do you intend to start stabbing?"
Volador asked, with an arched brow.
"No."
"Then I doubt such will occur."
Oates hesitated. He wished Alhambra were here to guide him, but she and Crafty had gone with the queen to the constructed wood. Volador cleared his throat.
"At least allow me to take the day's champions. It would be unseemly for them to deny those they have bested a chance to raise a cup to their victories."
Oates found Sluggard giving him an imploring look. Hoodwink's expression was blank.
"If it is for your hogs you fear, I have brought these men to stand guard in your absence," Volador said. "I will vouch for their safety."
"I'll stay anyway," Thresh said, giving the men-at-arms a hard stare. "If the rest of you want to go." Oates could see Culprit trying to hide his desire. Polecat was all but shivering with anticipation.
"Very well," Oates said. "We'll go."
Sluggard's smile threatened to sever his ears. Volador dipped a nod and turned, leaving the men-at-arms. Oates waved his brothers on, but tarried a moment with Thresher.
"I don't like the notion of you here alone," he whispered.
"Oh, I ain't," she replied, without lowering her voice. "Got the hogs here with me. Nothing gonna hurt any of us."
"Stay alert."
"I will. But you best heed your own words, big bastard."
Oates grunted with agreement and moved to follow the others, making sure to stride between the men-at-arms on the way. Full dark hadn't yet descended, but the lane between the pavilions was now lit with braziers. The feasting tents were filled with people and the glow of lanterns. Clusters of cavaleros loitered in the lane, often with a member of court simpering in their midst. As ever, the bastards drew stares and brought silence. Oates saw the shit eyes he expected, but also curt, manful nods and lifted cups.
"Well ridden, half-orcs,"
one Anvilis rider said, his four companions babbling what sounded like agreement in their own tongue. A broad-shouldered man stepped in their path. He was deep-browed, his face half eclipsed by the thick, flaxen beard of the Guabic. Though he was shorter than all but Volador, he stood without apprehension, pale eyes searching the hoof until they alighted on Hoodwink. He stepped up to the pale mongrel.
"You," he said, "you did greatness. I wish know how."
The man lifted a tankard in front of Hood's dead stare.
"Drink with us."
Oates had never seen anyone put a companionable arm around Hoodwink before. He tensed, waiting for the Guabian to spit blood as a knife entered his lung. But Hood allowed himself to be guided into a pavilion, where he was greeted with a boisterous yell. The Guabian turned and made a coaxing gesture at the hoof.
"Come, drink, yes?"
Polecat looked to Oates.
"Yes?" he asked, mimicking the frail's accent.
Oates nodded. With broad grins, the bastards entered the pavilion and were soon carousing with the Guabic knights and their women. Most didn't speak Hisparthan, but Sluggard knew their tongue. The Guabians had not entered the Pario and were more interested in his skills as a translator than in his victory. Oates learned they didn't race because all were entering the joust tomorrow and did not want to risk their horses. Hoodwink was the center of their admiration and curiosity. The men plied him with ale and questions and didn't seem to mind that both his answers and his drinking were sparing. Polecat and Culprit weren't so tempered. Oates tried to put a bridle on their quaffing and managed to keep them upright, but the celebration with the Guabians was only the first. Volador escorted the hoof to gathering after gathering. Each pavilion contained a knot of nobles and cavaleros, constricting as the bastards entered, and loosening as the boldest frail ventured forward to offer their compliments. A swaggering dandy, a cavalero making an overblown display of honor, a flushed lady looking to impress with her courage. There was always one ready to charge forward and be the first to welcome the half-orcs, their face changing with each pavilion. Oates and his brothers waded into each new fray, led by Sluggard, who charmed the forward assault within moments. He had men laughing and women blushing. Hells, he had women laughing and men blushing. He wore the skin of a champion well, never falling to boasting, but neither was he humble to the point of bootlicking. Oates was impressed with the way he kept close to Hood, often speaking for the silent mongrel, yet somehow preventing him from appearing hostile or simple-minded. It was a kind of magic, being earnest. It left Oates to focus on preventing Polecat from whipping his cod out at a baroness or some shit. But the former rudder was almost as easy in this company as Sluggard. His manner was less refined, but no less capable of treading these waters without drowning. And he kept Culprit afloat to boot, the younger mongrel at his elbow as they reveled with blue blood frails. There was still hatred in those tents, lingering at the edges with hard eyes and tight lips, but none were quarrelsome, as Oates feared. Still, he kept a sharp eye on his brothers and only nursed his wine. "Nothing will befall them here." Oates turned at the voice to find a woman beside him. She was less gaudily adorned than most, eschewing the towering, veiled headdresses swathing the heads of the other court women. Still, her hair, a pristine silver, was arranged in a fashion that Oates reckoned took several servants to accomplish. She wasn't looking at him, but the wry set of her lips suggested it was to him she spoke. That, and though they were in the company of many, no one else was engaged with her. "Pardon," Oates said. The woman raised a finger away from her goblet and wagged it at the gathering.
"They're all too well healed. Their fear of the queen suppresses any malice toward you. She's made it known her mongrel guests are not to be mistreated."
"Huh." The woman looked up at his grunt, eyes bright. Oates now recognized that bold stare. It was the same stare he'd spied on his way down the terrace. He'd been so quick to turn away, he'd not noticed the silver hair. It was the most obvious testament to her age. There were wrinkles upon her brow and framing her lips, but they were etched by good humor. Her skin was a touch darker than what was common among the court, showing some time in the sun over the years, but was otherwise flawless. Older, certainly, but far, far from a crone.
"It's just that you looked like a worried mother goose," she said, with a teasing smile.
"Oh." Oates drank from his goblet, for lack of anything else to say. The woman leaned toward him a hair and made a short, sharp hiss. Oates couldn't help but shoot her a confused look. "The hells?"
"Oates, I believe you meant. Your name."
"Right," he said, feeling a smile forming. "Oates, yes. Queer when folk already know that."
"Why? I can't imagine you often need to introduce yourself among the hoofs. Surely most in the lots know you by sight."
"Sure, but this ain't the lots."
"No." The woman sipped from her goblet. "No, it is not. Sometimes I find it is far more dangerous." Something in her tone gave Oates pause.
"You've been to the lots?"
"I was born there," the woman answered, her smile taking on a measure of pride. "My father's holding was near Zaret."
"That ruin on the Skull Sower's land?" Oates said, taken aback.
"It was not so in my girlhood," the woman replied.
"Shit. Pardon. I didn't mean to—" She waved his words off.
"Please. My loss shed its power to be renewed long ago."
Oates was relieved he had not caused her harm. "We were born within a few days' ride of each other."
"Plus 3 decades, I'd say."
That put this woman in her 50s. Hard to fathom, the way she looked.
"The bastard's lot lies between the Lucia and Badayat Hill, yes?"
"That's right.
There was nothing there when I was a child. Oates found himself staring into his cup.
Nothing there now.
The woman placed a hand on his arm. Forgive me. You're young enough that your pain can still be further bruised. Was it orcs?
Oates nodded. It had been the orc stains, in truth, but he wasn't about to speak about the hoofs warring on one another with a member of Ursaria's court.
I am Zana, the woman said suddenly. She rolled her eyes. I know. It sounds like a whore's name.
I wasn't thinking that, Oates replied, laughing and lying. But I reckon I was expecting some sort of contessa or something in the front.
Well, I have a title, though not, I'm afraid, one so lofty. I am Erika Hembra.
I got no fucking notion what that is.
Zana tossed back her head and laughed. No, I imagine not. It means my family is old and once held more than we do now. It means I was not worthy of a place at court until recently. But Her Majesty wished to surround herself with those with knowledge of Ulwundulas, so I found myself summoned. I swear I heard my father gasp in his grave when the herald arrived and I broke the queen's seal. Oates was coming to realize that Zana was more than a little drunk, but she hid it so well he'd missed the signs until now. So tell me, Oates, is this your first time in Hisparatha?
Yes. Zana narrowed her eyes a bit, but there was no scorn in her look. She knew he was lying, he was certain of it. But it seemed to amuse rather than anger her.
And?
I'll be glad when our task here is done. Zana nodded, drawing in a long, silent breath.
It has been 40 years since I fled Ulwundulas. And do you know what I still miss?
What?
Absolutely nothing.
Oates's laughter drew every eye in the pavilion. You truly are from there, he said when he caught his breath.
Hells.
A man in livery stepped into the pavilion and lifted his voice.
Her Majesty the Queen wishes her guests to attend her in the Prince's Wood.
Zana's stare flashed at Oates.
Time to award the champions. It was pleasant speaking with you, Oates.
With that, she turned and folded gracefully into the flow of nobles exiting the pavilion. Hundreds of candles now floated upon the lake in the constructed forest, bobbing in wide, shallow wooden bowls. The court and cavaleros gathered beneath the trees at the northern edge of the water, jostling for view of the queen. It seemed the common folk were not to witness the rewarding of the day's victors. Oates stood with the bastards at the rear of the crowd upon its left edge. Queen Ursaria, backed by torch-bearing bulls and the fire-eyed matron spear, lifted her voice.
Such a day! Worthy, I hope you all agree, of our beloved prince.
The court replied with a lusty cheer of agreement. Manrique stood to his half-sister's left and visibly shrank from the praise. Here and there, cavaleros added their voices, but most merely stood. They seemed eager for the night to be over. Oates didn't blame them. He longed to lie down. It wasn't fatigue so much as a desire to be in the quiet, away from so many. His every sinew had been drawn tighter than a thrum string all day.
And now I bid the champion of the Tavolado come forward.
Hoodwink slid from the hoof. Had it been any other brother, the bastards might have thrown some jests at his back and Polecat a swat at his ass, but they let Hood go unmolested. As he made his way around the crowd, a servant brought something to the queen. Oates couldn't quite make out what it was, but it was flat and pliable. It was a queer sight, Hoodwink standing before the ruler of Hisparatha. The scarred, hairless, bone-white mongrel had killed hells only knew how many. Orcs and thrice-bloods, cavaleros and god-blessed champions, all more formidable than the woman now in front of him, yet she was the most dangerous of them all. Oates wondered if Ursaria knew she faced a serpent, a cold-blooded creature that could strike quicker than an eye could blink. She would be dead before the bulls could react. Oates doubted even Ingrazia Bracara, standing nearer the queen than any, could oppose Hood if he'd a mind to murder. A cold fear gripped Oates's heart. Hells, was this Crafty's plan? To cut the queen down in front of her own court?
Hoodwink had been trained by the Black Womb. He claimed loyalty to Fetch and the Hoof, but Hood's hands came up and accepted what the queen held forth. He turned to go, and Ursariah laughed, high and clear, though without mockery.
"Wait, Hoof Rider, put it on."
Hood paused. He worked his hand into what Oates now saw was a heavy glove.
"Hold your arm up," the queen said.
Hood did as she said. The court gasped with delight as a falcon swooped from the shadowed trees to land on Hood's wrist.
"Suddenly glad it was him that won," Polecat muttered. "I'd have shat my britches if that buzzard came flying at me unexpected."
Thresher huffed.
"I might have slapped it out of the sky."
Culprit sniggered. Of course, Hoodwink hadn't stirred. He stood a moment, staring at the falcon. When it was obvious nothing further was to happen, he walked away, bearing his gift. He retook his place among the hoof without meeting any eyes.
"What are you going to name it?" Culprit asked.
Hood and his new falcon killed the young mongrel's smile with identical glances.
"And now to offer the reward for the most thrilling pario I have ever beheld," the queen announced.
She tilted her head and grinned.
"Though perhaps I should punish him for leaving me breathless."
There was laughter at this, including a chuckle from Sluggard, boots pawing the ground with eagerness. The servant who brought the glove now approached with a gilded saddle slung over his forearms. The gems upon the cantle flashed as they caught the torchlight.
"Hell's overburdened," Thresher gasped.
"Too bad it's for a horse," Culprit said.
Polecat cuffed him across the back of the head.
"It ain't for riding, fool ass."
No, but Oates didn't know what it was for. It had to be worth. Hells, he'd no notion. The damn thing was too heavy to pass to the queen, so the servant stood beside her.
"I call forward the champion of the race, our very own Master of Vittlers, Barasa de Oradal."
The court cheered and applauded, mercifully covering Culprit's outburst.
"The fuck?"
Oates was taken aback, but he managed not to expel any curses. He looked to Sluggard, now standing very straight and very still. His head was held carefully high. Barasa emerged from the crowd, flushed face bunched in a pleased smile. He knelt before the queen and, when bidden to rise, he went over and made a mummery of trying and failing to take the weighty saddle from the servant. The court laughed with appreciation. Polecat stepped to Sluggard's side.
"The hells is this?"
"The law," Sluggard replied. His voice was tight, eyes never leaving Barasa. "The owner of the champion mount receives the prize, not the rider."
"And you get nothing?"
Sluggard didn't answer right away, but when his words came, they were flat. "I'd forgotten." There was no feast held that night. None dined with the queen. Sluggard had been wrong about that, too. Instead, musicians invaded the wood and the nobles set to dancing. The court became a living wheel, the members moving with a unified precision as they circled and bowed, changing directions with the music. The cavaleros participated in some of the dances, but seemed to know when they should refrain. At times, only women indulged, at others, only men. It was a fluid beast of bodies, rippling and rolling in complicated patterns with practiced ease. After a time, Oates came to see it as a surging wall of silk and ritual the bastards could not penetrate. Only Alamra held the secrets to join, but for all her grace, she still appeared an outsider.
"Think I prefer the way the whores do it," Polecat said, his expression sour as he watched the latest crop of dancers. He leaned against a tree, Culprit asleep at its base. Sluggard and Hood had once again been drawn into the midst of the Guabians, now gambling with dice against the Majethi in a hunkered clump across the lake. The game had finally drawn Thresher into the revels, and from the sound of it, she was causing the humans to lose to a half-orc for the third time today. Polecat rolled his cup around and pushed himself away from the tree.
"I'm going to find one of them flagon boys. Get this filled. You want more wine?"
Oates shook his head.
"And neither do you."
"No,
Cat agreed, tossing the cup. How much longer you wager these frails will go?
Till the queen says, I reckon.
Ursariah had joined in the dance only once at the start, and spent the rest of the evening conversing with a steady rotation of nobles. Duke Hernan brought a handful of cavaleros into the queen's presence, and Oates saw the noblewoman Zana have a brief exchange with her. Manrique sat beside the queen, receiving all with a forlorn resignation.
Plucker's going to run back up to his mountain first chance he gets, Polkat said.
Oates didn't respond, but inwardly he agreed. If the queen was right, and Crafty aimed to put Manrique on the throne, the wizard would be hard-pressed to succeed. Oates didn't know much about court life, but it was clear the prince could hardly bear it. Another day of this, and he was like to go mad. He looked ready to crack even now, as if the music and dancers were grinding the grist of his feeble stores of resolve. Ursariah didn't need swords to thwart Manrique's claim, not when tourneys and minstrels would send him fleeing. The commotion from the dice game stilled, yet one voice continued to rise. Oates looked over to see Sluggard and Thresher walking away from the group, pursued by a man shouting and pointing, a woman a step behind him. Oates nudged Culprit awake with his boot.
Get up. We might have some trouble.
Just a frail, angry that he lost coin to mongrels, Polkat said.
I don't think so. Come on.
Oates started walking. The unease in his gut swelled as he closed with Slug and Thresh. The man coming after them was Hisparthen, a member of court from his clothes. His words were now reaching Oates's ears through the music.
Demand an apology! You'll not slight us and walk away!
Thresh had her hand on Sluggard's arm, encouraging him to keep walking. The nobleman was undaunted in his steps and in his words.
I'll not suffer your half-breed backs another moment! Turn! We will have your pardon, uncouth, impudent sootskins!
Teeth bared, Sluggard tore from Thresh's grip, whirling on the man. Oates reached him just in time, seizing his arm in a hold he couldn't break. Sluggard turned, his face enraged.
Walk away, Oates said. Whatever this is, we need to walk away.
Oates turned his eyes on the frails. Both were drunk, their expressions a hideous mix of haughty disdain and forced bravery. They were scared, Oates saw.
Walk away, he growled.
The man hesitated a moment, but the woman reached forward to tug at his sleeve. He blinked, sneered, spat at Oates's feet, and turned. The woman took his arm, and they retreated toward the dancing. Oates let Sluggard go.
What happened?
Fuming, Sluggard strode off without answering. Oates put the question to Thresher with a look. She waited a moment, the tilt of her eyes making it known she wanted Sluggard out of earshot.
They wanted him, she said, for their bed.
Oh, shit, Culprit said.
Thresher expelled a breath.
They said that fucker Barasa told them he could be had. And they'd already paid.
Sluggard shoved the man away, said he should learn to pleasure his wife his own self. Oates kept an eye on Sluggard, making sure he wasn't going to find Barasa, but he'd stopped a short distance away. Hells. Fetch used to jest that his hoof name be Whore. He'd come to the lots a gritter, a mongrel looking to get enough time in the Badlands to gain a story or three, maybe a scar. After, he'd profess no other wish than to come back to the kingdom and be a paid plaything for noble women. The Orcstanes had robbed him of that chance, and yet here it was anyway. Seeing him standing in that false wood now, Oates didn't think he'd ever seen a mongrel look more lost.
We need to get him out of here, Thresher said.
Oates nodded in agreement.
You three take him back to the house. I'll stay here with Hood. Watch out for Alamra.
Polkat, Thresh, and Culprit moved off without hesitation. Hoodwink stepped from the trees, where he'd been waiting, unseen, during the confrontation with the nobles.
Where's your bird? Oates asked.
Set free.
A trained falcon? Oates said, thinking of Tarif's eagle. Won't it just come back?
It needs no master to hunt.
You know they wear hoods, them hunting birds.
Hoodwink met his eye, one brow raised. Oates sighed.
Yeah, not sure why I said that either. They stood in silence, watching the dancing for a long while. While we're waiting, you want to tell me where Zhrika is? Oates muttered. No. Worth a try. It was another 3 lengthy dances before the queen finally bade the musicians cease. The bulls gathered around her as she took her leave, and Grazia Barcara leading the way down the path. The court waited until their queen was gone before shuffling away from the lake, many moving sore-footed. The drunkest were helped along by a friendly arm. Alamra and Crafty waited for the crowd to disperse, Fuchtus towering behind them. Several strides away, Manrique leaned over, his back turned. For a moment, Oates thought he was being sick, but the prince was only lifting a besotted Lucas from one of the stone benches. Glad that's fucking over, Oates said, when he and Hood approached.
Yes, Alamra agreed.
Her voice was tired, and her normally limpid eyes had dulled. Oates stepped over to Manrique and pointed at the swaying sack that was Lucas. Better if I carry him.
Thank you, but I have him.
The prince squatted and hoisted his senseless friend across his shoulders like you would a calf.
Perhaps I should have you do the same to me,
Crafty jested at Fuchtus, but turned his smiling face away from the demon before getting an answer. The wizard motioned at the path.
Shall we?
They left the wood. Manrique carried Lucas all the way to the paddock, but accepted Oates's help when it came time to sling the man over the back of his horse. Dozens of servants worked beneath the night sky, clearing the pavilions, scurrying over the terrace to prepare it for the next day, all under the watchful eyes of sentries wearing the queen's tabard. The air was cool, the stars undimmed by clouds. Tired as he was, Oates felt enlivened as he climbed atop Ugfuck. The pleasant ride up to the city was a balm to the boisterous day. Even within the walls, where the smells and buildings were thick, he found a welcome retreat from the pageantry. They overtook several of the slower-moving nobles, and Oates witnessed more than one coaxed off the street by the brazen calls of whores. There wasn't much of the night left, but some were willing to delay their rest to milk the last of its delights. Oates dreaded the coming day. The return of cheering voices, sumptuous food, endless talk. The thought made him want to keep riding, to delay his own sleep and forestall the dawn. Try as he might, he could not fathom a life here. What he'd seen of his Spartha was a lie. Had Beryl brought him into the world in these lands, he wouldn't be attending this spectacle from behind a feasting table with the queen not a spit to his left. He wouldn't even be across the field with the common folk. Maybe he'd have driven the stakes for the tourney field, or loaded the barrels into the wine wagons. Or he'd have been like Incas and Sluggard, made to fight or ride for the joy of the Blue Bloods. Or perhaps he'd be leagues away, working a lord's field, so distant and ignorant of the kingdom's rulers he would not even know their names, like Thresh once was. Beryl might have plied a trade, one he was meant to learn and continue, like Rant and Roar. No. Their father had been a frail, a thin shield of flesh able to protect his mongrel children for only so long as he lived. There'd have been no such father for him, a thrice-blood without a human parent to defy the world's hatred. Beryl's life, his life, would have been one of sweat and servitude. Ulwandula squeezed plenty of sweat, but there was a reason that Slug and Thresh, Anvil, Rant and Roar, and countless other mongrels had come south. Oates wondered if he'd been fortunate to be lot-born, to never have had to endure life among powerful frails. Or had it merely made him blind to the heart of all the hoofs stood against? Warbler knew, and the Claymaster. But did Oates himself? Did Jackal? Fetch? They knew that cavaleros were cunts and the crown was to be defied, but the source of that defiance was little more than an inherited spite. Was there enough potency in such handed-down ire to stop Hisparta from returning? If so, what would the lots look like after? Oates could not imagine Kalbarka rebuilt to mirror Majirit. He could not picture windmills in the Badlands. Mead and Sluggard had once dreamed of building an aqueduct, something Oates could hardly comprehend at the time.
Now he'd seen them, along with the fountains they fed. Such sights were marvelous, and yet still he could not find a place for them in the Ulwundulas he knew. Oates waited for the pang of restlessness to strike, the stirring in his blood that told him he needed to spur Ugg south and return to the lots, to the chief, to the fight. It did not come. He was disturbed to discover the thought of going home filled him with the same lack of fervor as another day at the tourney. Hells. Weariness was making him a maudlin fool. Inside the foreyard to the prince's house, they got Lucas situated once more on Manrique's shoulders. "I'll see to your horse," Oates told the man. "Yours too, Rue." Alamra handed him the reins with a grateful nod and followed Manrique inside. Crafty moved to lead Muckshovel into the stable, but Fuktu stepped in his path.
"Go," the demon said. "You need sleep."
Crafty said nothing, but he reached and placed a hand on Fuktus's arm, letting it slide off as he walked away.
"Be back to untack you,"
Oates told Ugfuck, leaving him in the yard as he took the horses into the stable. Hood saw to his sow and came to help. Together they got the horses stalled quickly. Hood drifted inside while Oates unsaddled Ugg and made sure his bed of straw was thick enough. Sleep, at last. Oates went into the house, turning for the stairs. A wailing scream brought his steps to a startled halt. A shape ran from the gallery across the inner court and entered the moonlight. It was Guiamar, the scullery girl. Her face was contorted with despair, and she stumbled in her flight, nearly blind with tears. Oates darted and caught the child in his hands. "What is it?" he said, kneeling to try and get a look at her face. She did not appear harmed. Guiamar sunk down, shaking. Her voice was stolen by sobs, but she pointed back the way she'd come. Oates heard others moving on the floor above. Fuktus was in the doorway behind.
"Watch her," Oates said, and ran for the back of the house, entering the room Guiamar fled to find a dark kitchen.
Nothing. Oates moved past the cold hearth to the stairs at the rear of the room leading down to the scullery. He could smell the smoke from a snuffed candle as he descended. He'd seen the awful, suspended silhouette that greeted him once before. The same sick shock gripped his guts as it had all those years ago. The same disbelief, followed in the next heartbeat by the cold truth of the act before his eyes. Then he'd been a young slop and rushed forward, gripping the mongrel's legs, lifting him to take the slack out of the rope, calling for help as he fumbled for his knife. Now he didn't move. He was older, and he knew. From the lack of swing in the body, from the horrible elongation in the neck, just enough to be unnatural, he knew it was too late. Sluggard had made a choice, and there was nothing Oates could do to help him now. Questions filled the numb cavity of Oates's mind, insistent and useless as he plodded up from the scullery, questions that soon fled his skull to seek new life upon the tongues of his brethren rushing into the kitchen. Thresh, cat, culprit. They all had weapons, but no boots, no brigands. They relaxed, seeing Oates, but while his slow steps eased the tension in their bodies, his face planted worry in their eyes. "It's Sluggard," it was all he could say as he moved past them. Out in the courtyard, Alamra sat on the ground, holding Guiamar. Fuktus had come farther in, his axe drinking the cold moonlight.
"What has happened?" the demon demanded.
The same question was in Alamra's stare. An anguished curse echoed from the scullery. "Polecat." Oates let that be the only answer. He looked up to the third story. Crafty stood at the railing of the veranda. Questions. Sluggard's act had spawned a host that would never be answered. The hoof would ask them again and again in the coming days. Oates had breath for only one. The one that could, perhaps, be answered. He lifted his voice at the wizard.
"Why are we here?"
It was too far to see Crafty's expression.
"Why are we here?"
His unanswered bellow fled the courtyard and perished beneath the small, remorseless square of fading night.
Chapter 35. Sluggard was cremated in a roofless temple, sitting at the base of the hills among the farms outside the city walls. Oates heard and immediately forgot the name of the goddess that was said to dwell there. If the state of her temple was any sign, she was ancient and poor. Manrique had known of the place, leading the hoof down not long after dawn. Three men and three women were already at work outside, cutting Hisparth's ever-encroaching wild grass away from the bleached stones with sickles. Seeing the riders, they ceased their labor. Sluggard's covered body rested on a wicker cart the prince had sent Lucas to purchase before the sun was up. That and a purse of coin were all the goddess's servants needed to see. There were preparations required. Washing and anointing, and whatever else these folk believed necessary to complicate the burning of a corpse. Thrash accompanied them through the entrance columns with the cart. The rest of the bastards waited among the dewy grass, fragrant from the fresh reaping. Manrique chose to linger with them. The court was to be entertained with a hunt this morning, and his absence would not be marked. Oates could sense Alamra was uneasy about the prospect of Crafty being alone with the queen, but she refused to leave. The girl Guiomar was also with them, too frightened to be left alone in the house. Oates was angry at Sluggard for that. Poor child had risen and gone down to the scullery to begin preparations for the morning meal. She didn't deserve to find him hanging there. Cat and Culprit were blaming themselves. Polecat hadn't even heard Slug leave the bedchamber they all shared, and Culprit thought he was merely going for a piss. "What were you to do?" Thresher had barked at them in the house before the cart arrived. "Watch him his every waking moment?" Selfish ass had made his mind. "Dacia," Alamra said, reaching out, but Thresh jerked away. "He should have come to me," she shouted, stabbing at her own chest with a vicious finger. "Why didn't he come to me?" She'd said nothing since. They were all quiet, worn out by grief, standing near one another, yet isolated in their own heads. Manrique and Guiomar waited a little removed from the hoof, the prince standing beneath a stand of pine where the horses were tethered, the girl sitting on a rock across the dirt track leading to the temple, her hands clasped upon her lap. Oates went to Manrique. "Thank you for this," he said, gesturing at the temple, "and for the coin it required."
"I regret it happened," the prince replied, rubbing his mare's nose. "The injustice done him at the race as well."
Oates nodded.
"If there is more I can do, I will," Manrique said.
"We're grateful." The hogs were hobbled a short distance away from the horses. Oates cut Ugfuck out and led him into the partially cut field. He called to Guiomar. When the girl looked up, he beckoned her over. She came at a dutiful walk, but could not entirely hide the trepidation in her eyes. "Need a favor," Oates told her. He pointed at Ugfuck. "He was under them trees where there's gilt chain growing. It's poisonous, and I don't need him eating it. So I'm going to walk him around. He does best with some weight in the saddle. Will you help?" Guiomar cast a look back at the tree.
"Aren't you worried about the other pigs?"
Oates shook his head. "They know what's good for them and what ain't. Ugg here never quite learned that."
"What do you need me to do?"
Oates patted the saddle. "Just sit up here while I lead him around. He won't buck or nothing." The girl squinted at the hog.
"I don't think I can get up there."
"Well, I was going to offer to lift you up." Guiomar thought a moment. She nodded. Oates scooped her up under the arms and set her on Ugg's back. She didn't weigh half what Murrow did, though she was a finger taller. "Now you can hold on here," Oates said, gripping the saddle pommel, "or his mane. You won't hurt him if you do. We ain't gonna go fast." Guiomar gripped the pommel with both hands. Oates started walking, keeping his hand on Ugg's left swine yanker, but it was just to keep Guiomar from getting nervous. Ugg would walk beside Oates all day without goading, and there was no danger he'd throw the child.
A snake could strike out of the grass, and Ugg would keep his calm.
Good up there? Oates asked after a span.
Yes. He smells a little.
Oates chuckled. A little. He remained quiet for several slow circuits of the field.
I'm sorry for what my friend did.
I shouldn't have dropped the candle.
Don't reckon anyone is sore at you for that.
A room in the house down the lane burned because the serving boy placed a candle beneath a shelf. His master whipped him, notched his ear, and sold him. He was lucky not to be branded on the face with the mark of a fire starter.
Shit, Oates said before he could stop himself. He cleared his throat. Manrique don't seem the sort to do that, even if the whole place was razed to the ground.
This is the first time I've seen the prince. It's Master Lucas that lords the house.
He mistreat you?
Oates tried to make the question light, but there was some tension in his voice he couldn't prevent.
He struck me a time or two,
Guillemar replied, with all the ease Oates had lacked.
Open-handed. Only once to the face. He's merry when he's in his cups and hosting whores, which is most days.
Hells, this girl had barely seen a decade, yet sounded full-grown. No, she'd have more bitterness in adulthood. For now, there was still no small amount of spirit in her.
Sancho used to hit me much harder, and more often.
It took Oates a moment to remember she meant her father, though his mind still conjured the long-dead whoremaster. He looked up at the girl.
What do you mean, used to?
Guillemar's eyes flashed wide for a moment, and her mouth drew tight.
No, of course he still does, when I've erred or talked willful. But I'm older now, so I make less mistakes, and he stays away more. But I'm sure he'll be in a fury when he hears I've dropped a candle, once he's back from Viravescos.
Buying Tradrian wine?
That's right. It's a long journey.
Oates stopped walking, and Ugfuck halted.
Guillemar, it was Anvili's cheese and Anatorgus when you first told it. I ain't as big a fool ass as some say I look.
Guillemar began to squirm, throwing a less than artful look back toward the prince.
You mustn't tell, she hissed, jerking back to face Oates. If Master Lucas finds out, he's likely to put me out in the street.
Lucas ain't going to hear nothing from me, Oates said.
Swear?
Guillemar asked, holding her breath.
Swear.
The girl exhaled. Oates set Ugg to walking once more.
When did he run off?
Just after winter,
Guillemar replied, her voice an old bruise, more ugly than pained.
Isn't much I can't cook as well as he did, so Master Lucas hasn't noticed. He's more for drink than food, anyway. He might have discovered it before much longer, but you all arriving has him distracted. I can say Sancho returned and went again, and perhaps fool him another month or two once you've gone.
What happens when you don't serve all this foreign wine and cheese your father's been wandering the kingdom to purchase?
Master Lucas rarely listens, and never remembers when he does. I'm wagering that so long as he doesn't starve or have to launder his own clothes, he won't get wise. I'll have to leave when I grow tits anyway, lest he try to make me some hearth whore, which I'll not be.
Then where will you go?
Guillemar's cheek met her shoulder when she shrugged. Oates didn't press it. Last thing this child needed was some lot-born thrice-blood, ignorant of most of his Spartha's ways, offering advice. All he knew was Ulwandulas, and there was nothing there that would benefit her. She was likely safer in the alleys of Majirit, should it come to that. They walked a while longer in silence.
Why'd he do it?
Guillemar asked.
I couldn't say, girl. I ain't met a Sancho yet that was worth a heap of hog shit.
No, not my father. Your friend?
Oates took a deep breath. He almost said he didn't know. It would have been simpler, and perhaps even the truth. But he'd been gnawing on it all morning. Hells, he'd thought about it often since he was a youth and found that fellow slop. He stopped once again and held up his left hand, showing Guiamar his shortened fingers.
"Lost these in a battle," he said. "The middle one here, that was gone when it happened. The other was still attached, but it was too crushed, too badly hurt. Best to cut it away. Might rot elsewise, and I'd lose the finger entire anyway. Or my hand. My life, even. Small wounds can do that, force you to suffer a worse injury to save your life. You can live without fingers, limbs. You likely knew that already." Guiamar nodded. Oates went on. "Sluggard, my friend, he suffered and survived some grievous shit. But there were other wounds, ones we couldn't see. They were in his head, his heart, and they were rotting. They hurt worse as time goes on. We didn't know it, maybe even Sluggard didn't know, but those wounds were killing him. Problem is, you can't cut those away and live, Guiamar."
"Do you have wounds like that?"
And there it was. The chance to unburden the truth. Oates wondered how many times Sluggard had been given that chance, how many times an earnest offer to lay his pain bare was put before him.
Not often enough, Oates knew from his own relationship with the mongrel. Thresher had raged that Sluggard hadn't confessed his torments to her, but what hoof rider admitted such to another? That fellow slophead hadn't, no doubt because he feared that revealing some inner weakness would surely have spelled an end to his bid for a brigand. It wasn't a thing you just came out and said, not to a sworn brother, and especially not to a young, fatherless girl.
"I," Oates told her with a smile, "have a giant hog that smells a little, and sometimes a lot." Guiamar laughed, and Oates realized there was always a reason to spare another discomfort. Sluggard must have spared them all countless times. Oates wished for all the hells he hadn't. The cart proved to be more than a means of transporting the body. When it was time, they went into the temple and found the conveyance was part of the rite. Draped in linen, it rested now in a broad stone basin at the center of the temple. Sluggard was barely discernible beneath the layers of cloth until the priests and priestesses began to pour oil from amphorae over him, and the sodden linen sunk to reveal his features.
"You may speak now for the dead,"
one of the priests told the assembled hoof. They all looked to Thresher. She took a deep breath.
"So much should have killed Sluggard," she began. "He was, in some ways, the softest mongrel I ever knew. In others, the toughest. And those were the ways that mattered."
She stopped speaking, and Oates thought she was through. But Thresh cleared her throat, started again.
"I've endured pain. Cruelty. More than most, I reckon. More than most men, for certain. And I bear the scars, out and in. I'm alive. But joy for this life was murdered in me a long time ago. With all that was taken from Sluggard, he never let them take that. At least that's what I thought. What his easy smiles convinced me to believe. Hells, he had a pretty smile."
Thresh's words were coming in throbs now, but she pressed on.
"Can't help but wonder now if it was a pretty lie, that smile. Wish I could see it again, have another chance to know. But I ain't ever gonna. Here's what I know. We rode together through this fucking kingdom, wanted and hiding, gathering up mongrels for months. He had courage. That was no lie. Neither was his friendship. Nor his grit. I don't never gotta wonder about that. Goodbye, Slug. Fuck this world for taking you from us."
The devoted of the goddess put flame to the linen. As Sluggard burned, Oates thought of killing Crafty. Fetch had said the wizard should die the moment he became a danger. He'd done nothing to hurt Sluggard, but he'd done nothing. Where were the schemes to weaken his Hisparatha? They'd trusted only that he would be a serpent, and, once again, he'd made them fools to trust. and once again, bastards were starting to die. Could very well be time to give Hood the order. And then? Hoodwink had said Fuchtus could not be bested. Oates reasoned that was true. Horned fucker had fought the chief to a standstill. What could any of the mongrels here do against him? Was killing the wizard worth all their lives? Even if they ran, they'd never make it back to the Lots, not without the protection of Tyrkania's envoy. And on the miracle they did, they would have accomplished nothing. They couldn't flee. They couldn't fight. They'd come willingly into Hispartha, and now it held them trapped. Sluggard had been so eager to return. Through their tears, his brethren watched him leave as smoke. From his place on the top tier of the Queen's Terrace, Oates viewed the joust in a fog of heartsick exhaustion. Were it not for the shrieking of the nobles, he might have fallen asleep where he sat. Dimly, he'd witnessed the tide of commoners swell to the brink of bursting the fence, raising a clamor as every man to participate in the lists rode in a parade around the field. Seeing them, it appeared the contest was for the most elaborate armor. Their plate was enameled in every color where it wasn't bare metal chased with bronze or gold. Many wore helms fashioned to resemble beasts and monsters. Others had the skins of actual animals affixed. Ribbons of silk, tied everywhere on man and horse, streamed behind the riders. The field cleared, and endless pairs of men were called forward by a herald to begin charging each other, again and again. Their hollow lances breaking upon shields or knocking a man from the saddle. Packed shoulder to shoulder upon the terraces below, the members of court shouted themselves hoarse at every match, the women often waving lengths of scarf. The noise made talk impossible, leaving Alamra and Crafty nothing to do but add two more pairs of eyeballs to the spectacle. It didn't look to Oates like Queen Ursariah would allow anything to distract her from the joust, even if it had been quieter. She stood for several of the cavaleros when they took their turns, a gesture that always renewed the din of voices. Oates ate but little and drank even less, knowing a belly heavy with food swimming in wine would put him in a slumber despite the raucousness. Guiamar stood behind Alamra, allowed on the terrace as her servant. The girl was enraptured by the contests. Oates was glad to see her shed the horror of this morning. He envied her a little. But the child saw more death before noon. A cavalero unhorsed one of the envilis, and the man took a hard fall. Oates knew he was doomed before he hit the ground. No helmet could save a neck from being snapped when falling at that angle. It didn't end there. The Guabic knights offered a fresh challenge, claiming that none were brave enough to throw down the hollow canyas and face them with war lances. The first cavalero to accept had his forearm snapped in two by the weapon before it carried through to pierce his pelvis. Rather than sober the crowd, the grim outcome stoked their howling. A Majethi had his shield arm torn off at the shoulder. He pitched from the saddle and died wallowing in his own blood. One unlucky Hispartan took the head of his opponent's lance through the eye slit of his helm. Oates heard his skull split over the roar of the crowd. It was only then that the queen called an end to the war lances and a respite for the joust. The commoners were not pleased and let her hear it, but she did not relent. Grateful for the chance to get out from behind the banquet table and stretch his legs, Oates followed the members of court down the steps. The hoof met him at the bottom of the terrace. The queen had not moved from her seat and was now speaking with Alamra and Crafty. Oates had thought she'd go to the wood, but perhaps she wanted to avoid Manrique, who had fled there shortly after the joust began. The thought of returning to the upper terrace forced a sigh from Oates. "Hood, keep an eye on Alamra," he said. "I'm about to crawl out of my skin up there. Culprit, go to the paddock, see if Thresher needs relieving. Cat, look to the prince."
"Fuck you is with him," Polecat replied.
"Is that blue devil a bastard?" Oates growled. Taking the point, Polecat raised his palms in pardon and ambled toward the wood. Oates meandered among the pavilions.
His mood was sour, and he allowed it to show, keeping the more exuberant nobles at bay with a rigid scowl. He found a pavilion occupied by none but the attendant servant and loitered there, staring at the overflowing platters upon the trestles. He didn't eat, wasn't even tempted, and the knowledge caused him to huff a breath. As a child, he dreamed of food, though the meager offerings of his mother's table had not stocked his imagination with what he now gazed upon. Fruits of every size and hue, piles of glistening game fowl, stout wheels of cheese. And this was but one table in one tent on a single day of this seemingly endless tourney. A few extra loaves of bread, an extra portion of beans, those would have been a hoard at the orphanage. His own time under that roof was bountiful compared to what the last crop of foundlings endured in the final days of Winsome.
Strange to revile what you once coveted, isn't it?
Oates turned to find Barasa smiling at him from the pavilion's entrance. The man stepped farther in to approach the trestles. He surveyed their contents with a cocked head.
I gorged for a month when I first gained Her Majesty's favor, he said, without looking up at Oates. Now I can hardly abide the smell of saffron and clove.
Barasa picked up a peach. His lip wrinkled as he turned it over, fingers clenching in pulses. He tossed it back down.
Take these away, he said to the servant. They're running to soft. Go fetch something suitable to replace them.
The boy jumped to the task, fleeing the pavilion with a basket of fruit Oates would have killed for in his boyhood.
Hells, he would have killed for it last year.
Barasa circled the provender, the sharp motions of his neck reminding Oates of a buzzard newly landed next to a carcass. Satisfied, the master of Vittler's looked up.
Most nights I sup on cinder bread and salted mullet, he said with a wry grin. The repast of a carnivale, master. My shits are easier, I found.
Oates turned to go.
Where might I find Sebastian?
The question stopped him cold.
Sluggard, I suppose I should say, though the name is horrid. Did he choose it to spite me?
Slowly, Oates faced Barasa once more.
I got no fucking notion, Frail.
About the name or where I can find him?
Pick one.
His hog wasn't among your other swine, Barasa said. Has he run off from you as he did me? The boy never had a measure of loyalty.
Shut your cunt mouth!
Barasa rolled his eyes upward and loosed a sighing, humorless laugh.
Madre, he has. Why does he turn tail whenever his fortune is within reach?
Fortune? The one you fucking stole from him?
Barasa waved that off.
A gaudy saddle. Useless for a lifetime or sold for a year's comfort. And none in Majirit would give a mongrel a good price. The hog is mine, so the prize was mine. I offered him something far more valuable. A second chance at what he desired, what we'd nearly accomplished before he ran off. Fool that I am.
Outside, the queen's heralds were calling for the joust to continue. Oates heard the nobles moving through the lane at his back.
Reckon you overestimated his desire to have you as his bawd, Oates said.
Barasa blew a disgusted noise from his lips and came around the table. He lowered his voice.
These fucking blue bloods are slaves to tradition. Everything, everyone, has a place in their world, and they brand it with their court speak. Every cortejo needs a Pandarus. They won't stoop to solicit Sebastian directly. He knows that. I'd have given him the coin. He's no reason not to trust me.
His former slaver, Oates muttered. Wager he'd more than enough.
Barasa came closer, his splotchy face darkening.
I'd no position when I found him. You think I was a lord to own a mongrel? I was the wagon-born son of a Gaillard. My inheritance was a keen eye for the knack. And that young half-orc had it.
I took him into my carnivale and trained him, fed him, spent the coin to get him the swiftest hog to be found in the kingdom. I owned Pala, not him. And he owed me more than the betrayal I got when he stole from me and ruined my carnivale.
You seem to have survived.
And bore no grudges in the bargain. Yet he spit in my eye again. Humiliated a backy baron and his marinating wife, for what? To show he's too proud now that he's a lots rider? No, can't be that, else he'd not have spurred away from you too. So what I'm coming to understand is, Sebastian, for all his gifts, delights in nothing so much as he does to repay affection with abandonment. Will you send your brethren after him? From what I understand, the mongrel hoofs don't brook desertion.
You know nothing of us, or him.
I know he was ungrateful. I know he was comely when he left, finely shaped, but he came back fleshy. And with the scars of that hideous sculpt pate, there was no chance of him catching lusty eyes the way he once did. If he'd not won the pario, I'd have been hard-pressed to tempt any with him. But I saw the chance, tried to take the sting out of him losing the saddle. And I know he ran, rather than show me a fig of gratitude.
He didn't fucking run.
Barasa drew his head back in a mocking way.
No? Then why do your bloodshot eyes blaze as we speak of him? Why does your jaw threaten to snap beneath that beard?
I may have risen to the queen's court, but I have not lost my eye.
You don't have the knack for mummery, Thrice. Your anger is not feigned. Sebastian has caused you grief, I can see it. He's put heel to hog.
No.
He's broken faith again.
No.
It's said you take on oaths when your flesh is inked. He's likely broken every vow he ever took.
Oates seized Barasa's doublet and snatched him close. The man's eyes went wide and he squirmed, but there was no chance of him breaking free.
You listen to me, Oates said,
pouring the soft, slow threat of his words down upon the little man.
Slugger didn't run. He's dead. That grief, you see, is for my brother, bastard, so you best think about how you next speak of him.
Barasa's struggles ceased.
Dead?
Oates let him go with a slight shove. Barasa straightened his rumpled clothing.
May I ask how?
Killed himself, Oates replied, unwilling to place shame on the act by hiding it.
Martyred Madre.
Barasa swore, jaw slack. It was quiet outside the pavilion now, though the cheers from the crowd were beginning to build from the direction of the tourney field.
Poor lad. But when you've suffered as he did, what man wouldn't?
Oates went cold.
What?
Barasa held up his hand.
I only mean it is a tragedy. He always revered the lots. To go down there, only to be so savagely mutilated.
The man shook his head with regret.
How do you know about that?
He wouldn't have told you.
A scalping?
Barasa gave Oates an incredulous stare.
I saw,